Are you guys rolling? Okay, well, we may want to leave that in anyway. Okay, good day, and this is our oh, we should even start the album with, like...
Wait, I'm behind the mic. Hold on.
Okay, get in.
Good day.
We'll start off like we...
Oh, the thing, yeah.
Okay, good day. I'm Bob McKenzie. This is my brother, Doug.
How's it going, eh?
Welcome to the Great White Album.
Take off. The Great White North album. This is our album, and welcome to it. Good day.
Oh, leave me hanging. We have to say a few things.
Go ahead, eh?
Okay. First of all, like, we're here, eh? And we got the Coleman and the spatula and the back bacon's frying up, and we're here with some cold ones. And the difference between, like, the album and our show is that, like, you can't see us, right? So... what you might want to do is look at the front cover while you're listening to this.
Look at me now.
Oh.
No, just look at me. Don't look at him.
Oh, get out.
Zoom in on me.
No. You can look.
How's it going? It's me, Doug.
Okay.
Good day, everyone. Okay, zoom out. Now look at Hosehead.
Everybody, I have Ilan Mastai with me. Say it correctly.
Excellent pronunciation.
Good God, thank you so much. You want to try mine?
Jason Klom.
Thank you. See, there we go. Yours is better than mine, though.
No, I think that you know, I'm just an upstart.
Right, right.
In the name pronunciation game, you're the real professional.
That is true. I do a lot of talking. Let's talk, first of all, about your film. A little bit.
Let's talk about it. What If?
What If?
Yeah, it's...
Is that gradually just dropping on you, the microphone? I'm sorry.
No, it's all right.
You can steal
mine. No, it's fine. I can adjust it. I like it because it gives me like a Robert Plant vibe.
That's nice.
Yeah. I like it. Which, I mean, I know that your listeners can't see me right now, but I definitely cut a Robert Plant-esque kind of... Yeah, exactly. So I appreciate that. What If? It's this relationship comedy that I wrote. It's directed by Michael Dowse, who made... Goon, which is a fantastic hockey comedy, as well as the FUBAR movies, and it's all gone Pete Tong. It stars Daniel Radcliffe. He made a series of movies about a wizard school. And Zoe Kazan from Ruby Sparks. We got Adam Driver from the HBO show Girls, Mackenzie Davis, Megan Park, Rafe Spall. Great cast.
That's the name that stands out to me.
Yeah, Rafe's great. The whole cast is actually fantastic and super, super funny. So it's relationship comedy. It's a very simple, relatable story. You know, it's about a guy and a girl who meet at a party and hit it off, and they have this instant kind of chemistry between them. But she has a boyfriend, and not just a boyfriend, a serious, long-term live-in boyfriend. And they decide that they like hanging out together, so they'll be friends. Mm-hmm. And just like, you know, most of us have been in this kind of situation, meeting somebody, having that spark with them, they're involved with somebody else, so you try to settle into just being a friendship. Right. But where it gets messy is friends then evolve into something else, and even if you go into something with all the right intentions, it can you know, get messy. And that's what the movie's about. It's about the messy kind of gray zones in male, female, and whatever kind of relationship. And it's very funny, but I think sort of hopefully the audience feels sort of surprisingly genuine in its emotion in between the wisecracks.
That's awesome. Like, I, you know, that's the thing about any good comedy, romantic or otherwise, is, it's simple enough, and you're exploring something complicated, but is a very simple side of it. And I do want to ask, how many times have you had to pitch that today, by the way? How many times have you had to say that?
I do. You do get kind of used to explaining it.
Natural,
yeah. Thank you. Thank you. I think with this movie, I mean, there's the rom-com, as it's sort of, you know, known, can be a bit of a debased sort of comedy genre, even though there's some like amazing movies that you basically classify as romantic comedy, The Apartment or His Girl Friday or Annie Hall, When Harry Met Sally is obviously a big one, even something like Knocked Up more recently. Mm-hmm. I think the biggest problem that you get with a lot of these movies is they're just totally phony. Like the characters are phony, the obstacles are phony, the jokes are phony. They're not, you see a lot of these movies where they're not actual jokes, they're like a joke. People say them like they're supposed to be funny, but there's not actually any wit there.
Right.
And so I wasn't I have to admit, I wasn't trying to like revolutionize the genre. I just wanted to write a romantic comedy that was actually romantic and actually comic, actually funny and actually heartfelt, and just fill it with great comic characters and let them bounce off each other. And you know, that's what we did.
It's awesome. Now, the one thing you did not have to do, and this is how I segue, by the way.
Very smooth.
Thank you. Speaking of segues, you did not have to fill your film with Canadian content. And that brings me to the album.
Yeah, that's right.
That was fucking gold.
That was an amazing segue talk about Bob and Doug McKenzie's Great White North.
I'm so glad I found a copy of it.
Because this is amazing that you found a copy of it. I'm actually like, I haven't seen this on vinyl in so long.
Now, when you had it, did you have it on vinyl?
I had it. Yeah, there was vinyl. I also had a cassette tape.
See, that's good. That's commitment.
I know, but and it's funny because I have it on my I have it like you know my iTunes. But one of the things I love about the album is they really embrace that it's a comedy album on vinyl. Like if you listen to it, there's so many kind of, I guess what we'd call now meta jokes about the fact that they're, not just that they're making an album, that they're totally making a cash-in album.
I know.
Like that they're just so upfront that they're just cashing in on the fact that people want to hear an album from them. They totally, they like actually use the like medium in the funniest way because this is side one of our album. Mm-hmm. On side two of their album, they, you know, make a whole big thing about make sure that you're not on the wrong side of the album. They do jokes about, you know, talking faster, about talking backwards, words about you know just like the actual amount of content that you need to actually fill a typical LP and as a kid listening to it I loved that because it was the first. I mean, I don't even know if anybody had done something like that before, but it was so innovative for me to listen to that it was not just a funny album, but it was a funny album that was going to riff on the idea of making a funny album.
It's fucking great.
Yeah, and that was very, I mean, that's very influential to me in my writing because, you know, even with something like What If, which is, you know, a romantic comedy, I wanted to, not in a parodic way like they came together, where it's sort of parodying the idea of a romantic comedy, but I wanted to make a romantic comedy in which the characters were aware that they're in a kind of a romantic comedy situation. You know, they live in a world where When Harry Met Sally exists, like they're aware of that movie. It's not like they're sitting around talking about it all the time, but you know, they know that this is sort of like a kind of a conventional situation to be in. But when you're in that situation, it's still funny and embarrassing and emotionally challenging.
Certainly.
And I kind of wanted to embrace that. And that's something I love about this album, because even when they do sketches, it's like two actors, you know, Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas playing these characters, and then the characters playing Bob and Doug McKenzie, and then often the characters are playing characters, but Bob and Doug McKenzie are much worse actors than Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas are, so they're constantly screwing up their own sketches and not caring. But they're such well-wrought characters. That's what I love about it. You know, Bob McKenzie is much sweeter, you know, more guileless, really wants to keep everything on track, you know, and he's clearly, neither of them are exactly rocket scientists, but he's clearly the smarter of the two.
Right.
And then you have Doug, who's like a total doofus, an idiot, but way more vain and venal and manipulative, loves taking credit for everything, loves manipulating and pushing around his brother. And that dynamic with them, they extend that even into the sketches. And they're often like, they'll fall out of the sketch that they're doing to fall back into their own repartee, which I love the actor's commitment to their characters and the character's total lack of commitment to the characters they're playing.
This is one thing in that I didn't get to look up, and I want to know how written this was, because I can't tell if the sketches were like, let's have them do a sketch where they're at a donut place, or you know what I'm saying? Like, because they had to have been written in character, which is another level.
Well, and I mean, you know, it has a huge influence on me, that feeling of you don't know if what you're watching is improvised or not.
Yeah.
You know, with What If, I mean, not to keep pulling it back to the movie, but I'm just talking about how this album influenced me in my writing. You know, it's a very written movie. People are often surprised at how scripted it is, because in a lot of scenes just feel like that the actors are improvising. And we did use targeted improvisation.
Sure.
But the point of it was to make it feel like you're watching something that's just, you're watching some funny people riffing.
Of course.
And you have amazing improvisers like Adam Driver and Zoe Kazan, Mackenzie Davis, Megan Park, and Daniel Radcliffe is actually a fantastic improviser.
Awesome.
I'm actually totally happy when people ask, like, well, how much of the movie is improvised? Aren't most of those scenes improvised?
Right.
And that's what I like, because I love that feeling of you don't know. You don't know if these are two idiots just trying to fill up an album worth of material mm-hmm. to cash in, mm-hmm. Or a brilliantly written album about two idiots
yeah.
trying to fill time yeah. to cash in.
It is one of the most, like you said, very meta, but it is, like, I keep looking for albums that are self-referential, are aware of the medium, because, again, it's essentially dead. The medium.
Yeah.
Not entirely. There are companies out there that are pumping out records, comedy records, but it's not a thing. You can't go off the assumption where at the very beginning they said, well, look at the cover. That one's me. That one's him.
Yeah.
You know, they keep referring to that. Picture him naked. Oh,
yeah.
Okay. That's another thing. Thanks, Doug, for reminding me. The album's in stereo, right? Okay. So, like, I'm in, like, one ear, right?
And I'm in the other.
Okay. Excuse me.
Oh, nice one, eh?
Sorry.
Oh, beauty. And I'd like to apologize to your right ear on behalf of my moron brother.
If Hose had his choice, he wouldn't be in your ear. He'd be in your nose doing some mining of mineral resources.
Booger nuggets.
You'd like that.
Okay. Now, are you listening? Here's me getting up, okay? Now, I'm going over here.
No, no, no. Sit down. Get out. Oh, way to knock over that. Get out.
Sorry.
Oh, come on, eh?
How's it going now?
Okay.
I'm over.
What are you doing? Oh, way to go. Sit back.
Okay.
You blew it. I knew it. Watch your head there. Okay. So, like, I'm trying to get the album done, okay? Why do you have to do this?
Sorry, Jose.
Okay.
I'm having a good time here because, like, no one can see us, eh? So, like, you don't even know if we're nude, eh?
Get out. They do, too.
They don't, eh?
Yes, they do.
Me and my brother are here nude.
No.
So, like, imagine us. Okay, look at the album now, eh? Okay, now look. Imagine, there he is. There's Hose Head
yeah.
with no clothes on.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And what about you?
He's really built, eh?
Get out. Oh, come on. Okay, we're not nude.
We could be nude.
I know. I love that about it. Like, and, you know, there's a sketch on here where you are supposed to fill in your dialogue. You're going to be a guest on their show. And they included the actual lines you're supposed to say in, like, the liner notes of the album. So theoretically,
I was wondering about that.
You're supposed to, like, take them out and, like, read along. And then, but of course, even that sketch, like, goes completely off the rails.
Yes. Yeah.
And I mean, all those, you know, and the album in here, like, you know, it's like the liner notes are so amazing.
Mm-hmm.
And even the liner notes are so meta, because you're looking at a photo of a bunch of stuff that's, like, set out as if you're, like, looking down at the table in front of you,
mm-hmm.
theoretically what the table in front of them would be looking like
uh-huh.
when they're recording the album. And the intelligence of that, but also the total, like, bonehead irreverence. You know, I mean, when you talk about improvisation, I mean, you know, Bob and Doug McKenzie just started as filler improvisation.
Right.
Because when SCTV moved to the, you know, when the broadcast moved to the CBC in Canada, because it was a Canadian-made show.
Mm-hmm.
And as an aside, I was in LA, you know, we've been doing this press tour, and one of the places we stopped on the press tour for the movie was Edmonton. Mm-hmm. And I actually got interviewed on TV in the studio where they used to shoot SCTV,
really?
And it was amazing. Me and the director, Mike Dowse, we actually seriously considered stealing some of the SCTV memorabilia.
Of course,
they have this amazing, like, framed photo of John Candy on the wall of the studio. We're like, we're so taking this right now.
Holy shit.
Nobody would have even stopped us.
No, of course not.
But you know, when they moved to the CBC, they had to deal with, because they went from a private company to a public broadcaster. The CBC is basically like the BBC of Canada.
Right.
So they actually had Canadian content regulations. They had to have a certain amount of Canadian content. And
yeah.
Bob and Doug McKenzie started basically to fulfill those Canadian content regulations with the biggest finger possible. They're like, you want us to make it feel more Canadian? Fine. We are going to basically just come on screen for the minimum amount of time. How long do we have to be? 2 minutes and 30 seconds? Okay. We're going to just play with every Canadian stereotype.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be the most, like, pathetically, ridiculously Canadian thing. We're not going to write a note of it. We're going to improvise it completely.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just they're just giving a finger to basically the government regulators.
Uh-huh.
But amazingly, it took off.
Of course.
And they became like the most famous characters on SCTV,
mm-hmm.
which is saying something. But it started as essentially like this irreverent, improvisational, kind of anti-establishment thing.
Yeah.
But it was real. I mean, I'm from Canada. I grew up in Canada. And it was actually very seminal for, I think, Canadians, because, you know, stereotypes in comedy, you know, they're often like a way of talking about, you know, some group
mm-hmm.
and kind of packaging who they are
yeah.
in a sort of a very essential way. But part of what's bound up in stereotypes for the people that are being stereotyped is a lot of shame. It's
definitely.
Like, you know, and that's part of what makes it, can make it funny, but it can also make it rankle. And there's something about these two guys going on and throwing, like, every stereotype, the stupid toques, the flannel, the three B's, beer, bacon, and beavers, right. You know, this giant picture of the Great White North. They're just guzzling beer and being total idiots. And everything that Canadians fear Americans think they are, like living up there in the freezer of North America. But by doing it, they actually, and by making it so funny and so outrageous, it's like they exploded that stereotype.
Definitely.
And Canadians like totally not just embraced it, but it's like you never had to deal with it again because it was such an extreme version of it. Mm-hmm. And I think it was a real watershed moment in Canadian comedy. And I think you see a lot of Canadians sort of being inspired by SCTV for sure, but Bob and Doug McKenzie in general to kind of take pride in a certain kind of Canadian style, which historically, it's sort of like the perfect balance of the British style of comedy and the American style of comedy. And that's what SCTV did so brilliantly. And even though in their sort of like truly committed, outrageous Canadianness, Bob and Doug McKenzie kind of exploded that stereotype and sort of like liberated in a way Canadian comics to forge new ground. And I think, you know, guys like everybody from like, you know, Jim Carrey and all the guys that came out of SCTV and, you know, people like Mike Myers, the kids in the hall. I mean, you watch Wayne's World. Wayne's World is basically just Bob and Doug McKenzie.
I was thinking the same thing listening to it.
Oh, it's totally. I mean, like Wayne's World is hilarious, but it's sure. essentially just a suburban Bob and Doug McKenzie.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot to think about. What's really funny, too, is I don't know if you remember or saw on the back the really hilarious content sticker on the back.
Oh my gosh, I haven't looked at this record in a long time. It's so funny.
Because there's always
Dear American Record Buyer.
Oh, that's right. It does.
Yeah. Over the past several years, the Canadian recording industry has tried to produce a product which would not only entertain an international market, but would raise the profile of the Canadian, help the world understand the Canadian, and reinforce the concept of a true Canadian identity. Yeah, this is the whole thing. It's like, it's they're both just making fun of everything. Every government idea of like this kind of government mandated culture, every sort of stereotype, but they're also totally embracing it too. Yeah. Like that idea of like, I mean, again, like just to tie it back to the movie I wrote, like that it's funny because it's like sometimes you don't even think about the influences you have until you're sort of confronted by them, because I felt like that. It's like I wasn't trying to run away from writing romantic comedy. I just wanted to write like a good romantic comedy.
Sure.
I kind of wanted to embrace the genre but also return it like but actually still make it like super entertaining and funny and moving.
Yeah.
And that idea of both like embracing it and at the same time being totally irreverent and making fun of what you're doing, I feel it is very Canadian and is very Bob and Doug McKenzie.
It definitely is. I mean, obviously you have to step away a little bit and can't be completely self-referential without people probably beating you up about it. Whereas sketch comedy, it's a little more accepted.
Yeah, of course. But I mean, this is what's... Yeah, no, I mean, absolutely. Like, I mean, I don't... You know, they're trying to... I have to maintain a certain psychological realism to make the movie work. Otherwise, it does become something like They Came Together, which is funny, but you don't actually ever care about the characters.
Right.
Like, that fundamental thing in a romantic comedy of, like, wanting them to end up together, you don't really feel because they don't care about that. That's not the fish they're frying.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing I do love about Bob and Doug McKenzie, though, is they even though the characters, you know, that they're playing, could, like, don't care or totally, they're phoning it in the context of this sort of, you know, role they're playing. But it's the commitment of the actors; like, they never waver.
Mm-mm.
And that's what's amazing about it is they're totally committed as performers to these idiots.
It's to the point where when they crack, quote unquote, I don't know if they're cracking, legitimately, or if that's the character supposed to be cracking. That's how freaking good these guys are.
Yeah, and some of the, I mean, you know, like some of these sketches that they do, what I love about it too is, you know, they have this thing where they're like, okay, now we're gonna have the hit song on our album, and then they do this hilarious song with Geddy Lee from Rush, Take Off, which actually became a hit song.
Not surprised. That's freaking great.
And you know, as a Jew, the 12 Days of Christmas song, I was like, that was basically, I kind of just thought that was the 12 Days of Christmas. Like, I don't even know the 12 Days of Christmas, but I re-listened to this album recently, and I realized I knew the 12 Days of Christmas completely by heart. But the minute I heard it, I'm like, I haven't heard this in a long time. I know this exact song, this whole song by heart. Even, my favorite part about it is that they basically give up at around 8 or 9 because it's too hard.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, that's the best thing about the song is it's called the 12 Days of Christmas. They literally stop coming up with stuff at about day 8 and then just kind of just like mumble along with the rest of it.
So good. And they're actually, I don't know, are they the first guys to do that popular of a 12 day? Because that became a thing in the 90s, I can recall. There's a lot of really shitty Christmas parody songs. And while that's not the biggest landmark of the album, I think that's interesting that, you know, probably a bunch of people stole from that.
Yeah. Well, you know, I said this to you before we started the show, but I actually, growing up in Canada, I didn't have a perception of whether this was actually, whether anybody in America even knew about this. I mean, I sort of vaguely, I knew that people know about SCTV, but, you know, I think a lot of people find SCTV because of all these amazing Canadian comics that started there.
Sure.
John Candy, Martin Short, Catherine O'Hara, Andrea Martin, sure. Eugene Levy, and then Harold Ramis, of course, who was the American on it, but who was brought up from Second City in Chicago to kind of like write the show and be a big part of it. So I think a lot of people sometimes discover SCTV because of what the performers went on to do. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think for most Canadians, that's where they started their relationship with them.
Right.
But I didn't have a perception of whether anybody even knew about Bob and Doug McKenzie, but I Googled it right before I came in here, and it sold a million copies in the U.S., which is actually amazing.
Yeah, that shocked me. I mean, I knew about them growing up, but it was, you know, it was sort of, it was peripheral. They always, SCTV was always the punk to Saturday Night Live's mainstream, even though Saturday Night Live was punk for American comedy, you know, so they're even deeper, you know?
Well, that was a big thing about SCTV in general. I mean, it really does have the most brilliant idea for a sketch comedy show ever, which is that what you're watching is the programming of a fake cable access TV station, and they're too cheap to buy programming, so they just make it all on a super low budget. But it gave them the freedom to do anything.
Yeah.
But the thing that was so great about it, not just that it was so irreverent and the way it riffed on pop culture and society in general, the absurdity and surreality, but it was that all the performers were so committed to their characters.
Yeah.
And the character work was so great. And that's what made everything elevated. That idea of like a performer, and it's obviously part of Bob and Doug McKenzie in general, that idea of like a really good comic actor committing to a performance of a character that's bad at their job, you know, and is like totally half-assing it and doesn't care, but the actor cares enough to show all of that.
So good, and it's one of those things where this could be a throwaway for somebody who didn't quite get it, because it does feel like they're dragging me along for 45 minutes in a great way. It's all brilliant, but it does, you definitely still feel like they're poking at you for 45 minutes.
Yeah, it's like they're almost making fun of you for buying the album.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah.
Okay, good day. Welcome to side two of our album. Okay, we should do this, okay?
Okay. Oh.
Okay, so, like, this is side two of the album, right? Okay? And, like, I know sometimes when we get an album, like, we don't know what side to put on first. Like, sometimes you put on side two first on purpose or by accident.
So, like, if you put this side on, then, like, take it off.
Yeah.
Take off. Go back to the other side,
eh? Put on side one first, right?
Okay, stop listening.
Yeah.
Okay, shh, don't talk.
Don't
talk. If we keep talking, they might listen.
Yeah, they'll keep listening.
Shh,
right, okay, keep quiet, okay?
Okay, shh.
Okay, put on side one.
Put it on, eh?
Yeah. Okay, stop talking.
Shh.
Okay.
I did.
You didn't.
No, I don't.
I said shh, and you kept talking.
No, I didn't. I stopped.
You did.
Take off.
You hose head.
Okay, just... Okay, I think everybody's back now.
Yeah, all right.
Okay.
There's one thing that I was thinking about, too, is that obviously they're playing with the idea of the content. Now, was the content mandated, do you know? Was it simply for the sake of finding a national identity or keeping that alive? Is that the reasoning for it, for having Canadian content?
Oh, you like the Canadian content regulations?
Yeah.
Well, the idea, I mean, I think the thing for Canadians is because we share the same language and a very porous border. I mean, most Canadians, the majority of their entertainment is U.S. entertainment.
Sure.
We watch all the same TV shows, have all the same bands, have all the same movies, all of that sort of stuff. And so there's a perception, there's a sense that the government, that like that kind of cultural imperialism can be overwhelming. I mean, really, you know, because we share a border and because we share a language and because the cultures are so intertwined, there's a sense that Canada is, you know, and I think this comes out of more of like a 60s and 70s mentality more than now, but I think at the time it's that sense of like Canada is like the front line on like American cultural imperialism, and if like, you know, like as it washes over Canada, like, you know, Canadians didn't want to essentially be like this vast 51st state.
Yeah.
And so there's various ways, and some of them were like economic, like there's laws about how much much ownership of Canadian companies American companies can have, which again is sort of like a throwback to time before they were like these transnational corporations where you like literally don't even know where they're technically from.
Of course.
You don't know where they pay taxes, if they even pay taxes. But that idea of that something about kind of like Canada had to be protected as its own national identity. Now, what that national identity is was always a bit of a source of questions and confusion, which is where these hilarious stereotypes that they kind of like explode came from, because because the sense of like, it's a sketch, we're a sketch comedy show. What are we supposed to do that's so Canadian?
Yeah.
Oh, okay, we'll do this like ridiculous talk show parody about the Uber Canadians.
Yeah, which I think is... at the end of the day, I mean, it's ironic in a few ways. I mean, obviously that it would explode when the whole point of it is, again, to be purely Canadian.
Right.
The idea that this – but I think it also then gives people like myself who have had zero concept of what Canada was,
right,
besides that place in the north, gives us this idea of what kind of a sense of humor they have,
right,
about themselves. And it gave, there was this weird thing in the 80s, at least for me, that I noticed watching David Letterman a lot.
Mm-hmm.
He really loved to fuck with Paul for being Canadian.
Yeah.
But it was the most innocent, like, you know, there's this rivalry that maybe at one point was a lot more solid, but at least for comedians, I think is this gentle rivalry, which
right,
makes me so happy.
Yeah.
And this is a huge part of that, you know? Whereas, again, you know, we can't, you know, it's not like Larry the Cable Guy's being ironic. So we've unfortunately got that pouring out of our fucking sleeves.
Yeah, I mean, Canadians, irony is the sort of like essential default position.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, I think that, you know, you've seen, I mean, the U.S. tends to be a much more, much less ironic kind of environment,
sure,
cultural environment. Of course, irony is obviously a big part of society here as well.
Sure.
But it's so embedded in Canada, mm-hmm, that irony, that I think it's almost like that's the water we live in.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you come up for water and you're like, oh, look, genuine sentiment. Oh, this is weird. I'm going to go back submerge myself in irony again. I think it's just a naturally kind of like hyper-ironic culture. Now, of course, we've seen like these comedians come out of Canada and become incredibly influential and help define American comedy, and that kind of like warped, ironic, kind of detached approach to kind of genre,
yeah,
and conventions is very Canadian. And as, you know, you see these different performers, because we can slip in unnoticed amongst you. I think, you know, the influence of a lot of Canadian performers on like American comedy has been really profound and in a really, yeah, interesting and fun way.
Yeah. And I do wonder, it must be the approachability thing. It's not, you know, the accent's only slightly different.
Yeah.
You know?
And we can take it off at will.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. It's not even that different from several, you know, there are enough American states that have almost identical.
Absolutely.
There's also, I don't know if you noticed in this, there's a nice little order form in here where you can order some Bob and Doug merchandise, which I think is fantastic. I'm glad that's intact.
Actually. And there's a special thing for Nevada residents to add applicable sales tag.
Oh.
Yeah. I love it. Well, this is the thing. I mean, you know, that's part of their irony about it is,
mm-hmm,
is that they make what a cash grab it is totally up front.
Mm-hmm.
They're not hiding it at all. And yet it doesn't detract from the pleasure of it.
Not at all.
And it's that sense of that the comedy can be all encompassing. It doesn't have to be one person pretending like they're talking to you,
yeah,
and that they're sitting next to you or the kind of like typical sort of illusions that kind of comedy albums often try to preserve.
Mm-hmm.
They just explode that completely.
Yeah. What the crazy thing to me is that they have this opportunity to be mainstream, and again, there's a hit. It's a hit. It's obviously a hit, but it's not just a hit. It's a completely experimental album that became a hit that sold a million friggin' copies.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I liked a lot of like comedy albums growing up, and I used to love listening to them over and over again.
Mm.
But you know, this one when you hear a comedy album like this, especially at a young age,
mm-hmm,
it sort of almost makes it hard to just listen to other comedy albums which aren't sort of like acknowledging any of the sort of just the limitations or the medium itself in,
yeah,
any way. And so once you've heard these guys just like making fun of and acknowledging all the things about like how they're recording and how they're in stereo and one's in one ear and one's in the other and how like that they have to, you know, like they'll stop talking to pretend like the track is over, or they'll talk about how they got to keep talking for another couple, like another 30 seconds because the needle isn't quite at the end and all of that sort of stuff. It makes it, I mean, that's part of what they're doing in a very kind of like irreverent but subtle way, which is just drawing attention to the artifice of it all.
Mm-hmm.
And then when done well, it can't but help but make you be aware of the artifice of of what you're normally watching.
That's true.
Yeah. And I mean, again, that was like a big influence on me. I mean, I wasn't with What If trying to, you know, just deconstruct the romantic comedy genre and leave like a pile of like burning tropes in our, in my wake. I just wanted to like write a really good romantic comedy that was like really funny and really romantic, like I said before. But part of that is hopefully you watch it and then it's harder to like enjoy a phony lame one that isn't funny and that where everything is so contrived and where the characters are just these sort of like marionettes going through these contorted sort of plot, machinations. I like that aspect of it too, that in doing it well, you draw attention to it when it's done poorly.
Sure. Do you, when you were growing up listening to, so what are some other albums that maybe weren't necessarily ruined by this one, but just some other stuff that you were listening to at the same time, or maybe the first albums? Did you buy this one yourself, actually, or was it something your family had?
Oh, man, that is an excellent, it would not have been something my family had.
Really?
Yeah. I'm just like trying to cast myself back to like the 80s. This would have been around a lot because it came out in 1982 and I was a very small child. I wouldn't have heard it at the time. And so my recollection of it is the kind of thing that you get introduced to by a friend who has a cool older brother.
Okay.
And you listen to it and like, you know, I remember like it being put on and then, you know, listening to it and just like with everybody and kind of getting onto its vibe and that like, and then it, I mean, when I was a kid growing up, I mean, doing these bits with each other was, everybody knew all the bits and we'd riff on it all the time and try to perfect our, I'm not even gonna be able to do it, but our like, I mean, but that's another thing that I love about this album. There's a runner that goes through their whole album where they're drinking beer and trying to get each of the level of the beer to the point where they have like 12 beers around them so they can actually, they can actually whistle the kuru-ku-ku-ru-ku-ku properly. And they keep like, you know, they do it, but they don't quite get it. And so they have to keep drinking and drinking. And so the actual concept of the album is they're like drinking their way through enough beers to actually be able to do that properly. And so they're completely wasted by the end. And then at the end, they actually, like, spoiler alert, finally do it. Mm-hmm. But they're so wasted and they've drank so many beers that they're just like a disaster. And that's one of the things that's great about the album is whether or not it's two actors just doing an amazing job of playing these two idiots getting wasted, or if they were literally actually getting wasted in the recording studio, you will never know.
No.
You will never be able to tell.
And that's the other thing too, is it's got an arc. How many comedy albums have an arc?
You know, it does have an arc, and it has like a whole interplay between the brothers, and they never lose track of that dynamic between them, which is what makes it not just a sort of like throwaway improvised cash grab, which actually is that, you know, Rick and Dave like totally commit to the dynamic between them. They never lose track of that older brother, younger brother dynamic, and it plays all the way through, and there's a whole arc, and they have little runner jokes that run through that actually pay off at the end. And so when you realize that, you realize that there is a sophistication in the writing that's just like under the hood, that's just purring quietly, and that in fact you shouldn't notice it because you're too busy focusing on just sort of the witty repartee and the chemistry between them.
Okay, one pineapple filled donut.
Thanks.
And a six-pack of Krillers.
A six?
Yeah, for me, eh? I didn't have any dinner.
And you're not gonna have any breakfast either.
Oh, and two coffees, yeah. Make his black, and mine's triple sugar and triple cream.
Boy, go to the dentist. Okay, I have a topic.
Okay.
While we're waiting.
Go.
Okay, you know, in the Great White North, it went metric, right?
Yeah.
Before anywhere else in the world, right?
Yeah.
So, like, a lot of people don't know how to figure out metric, right? Okay, so
me neither.
Okay, I'll teach you. So there's a fast way, which is to double it and add 30, okay? So like if it's, let's say, on the radio it says, okay, so today it'll be cloudy and 5 degrees. So how do you do it? You go, you double it, 5 is 10, you add 30. 30 and 10 is 40. It's the old 40 degrees. So when you say 5 degrees, 40.
Like how many beers would that be if you want like a six pack in metric?
6, 12, and 30, 42 beers. 42 metric beers.
You know, the other funny thing, too, is like I feel like any American who wants to do a Canadian reference, Geddy Lee has to be in there, and it's perfect that he's on here.
Oh, and he's hilarious on the album.
Yeah, he's great.
He's so funny on the album. And that was cool, too. Because, I mean, I actually wasn't that into Rush. I their song, the Takeoff song, actually was my entry point to Rush, which is very strange. Great. Well, because, you know, also, I mean, I was, you know, when I was discovering the album, I was like, oh my God, Geddy Lee is like amazing and hilarious. And then you sort of discover these like grand sort of like epic, weird sort of like, you know, Tom Sawyer songs from them, which aren't exactly like Takeoff.
No, not quite. Yeah. I mean, I think he's messing with his own voice and not even giving you his best singing, you know?
Why would he?
Why exactly, you know?
Yeah. I mean, the premise of, he totally embodies the hoser, you know, the kind of hoser stereotype too.
He says he gets $10 for the record.
Yeah, $10. Yeah. He did it for $10. Hey, $10 is $10. absolutely. No, it's so funny and just like thinking back on the, you know, there's many kinds of laughter, but there's two that I always really think about in writing comedy. There's laughter of surprise and there's laughter of familiarity, you know? And the first time you hear something, it's a laughter of surprise because you're taken aback, it's unexpected. But it doesn't explain why you can go listen to a comedy album or a movie or a TV show or whatever over and over and over again and still laugh. Yeah. And, those laughs of familiarity when it's sort of nostalgic. You're remembering what it felt like the first time you laughed at it, and it triggers that part of your brain to laugh again. And an album like this, it's hard for me to even, I mean, if somebody's listening to this podcast, I mean, I definitely encourage you to check it out, but I don't even know if it will be like hilarious to a modern listener.
Yeah.
But to me, I listen to it, I start laughing because I remember what it felt like to be listening to the first time, getting together with groups of friends and listening to the whole album to the point where we could practically speak along with it, you know, and riffing on these jokes and whispering them to each other in class or calling them out at each other, you know, at parties. You know, the kind of the humor becomes part of the fabric of your friendships, and so it kind of becomes more than just a comedy album. It becomes part of your youth, you know.
Yeah.
And so discovering it from like a cool older brother, and getting my own copy, and I remember getting it on cassette. Mm-hmm. I remember having a cassette that I wore out a lot, and I remember there was something really funny to me about like listening to a cassette of a record, which was very clearly made to be a record
right.
And then you're hearing the cassette version of it, and now it's just like an MP3.
Yeah, that was the other thing too. Is I'm like, I'm glad I at least had this in hand while I was still listening to the digital version of it,
because
I would have missed a whole lot. There's this interesting. That's one thing we talk about on this a lot is if you made friends over comedy, or if you made friends through. But you obviously this was a big shared thing, and like I feel like emotionally something like this. It's great that we the two of us could relate on it, even though I didn't grow up on it. I actually do love it. I'd never heard it before until recently. It's great that we can relate and that it crosses borders, and that's wonderful. But it does, there's something where emotionally it's Canadian, it's yours. You get to have that. And I really like that about this too, because I'm like, you know, there's still some shit in there that I'll never get and will never mean that to me.
Yeah.
It will never be emotionally funny to me.
Yeah.
And I kind of like that.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think the best comedy is very specific.
Mm-hmm.
And even if you don't get the references, there's something sort of about the specificity of the comedy that you... Like you get that they're talking it, like you get that it's like an opening onto a world that you don't totally understand, but it's but sort of almost more interesting because of that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It's the same reason why somebody like me would ever be interested in Monty Python. It's why they exploded.
Right.
It's like, oh, these funny voices are like, you know, it's some of the accents are hilarious, which obviously they're not funny to English people, but most of the voices that they do are great. And so that's what brings people like me in first.
Right.
And then eventually you realize, oh, this is fucking brilliant.
Yeah.
So were there any other albums that you grew up as a kid listening to? Are there other comedy albums that maybe influenced you as heavily as this one?
Yeah, I mean, like, I was a big fan of Steve Martin and Bill Cosby. I feel like those are two kind of pillars, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in terms of like, because you're talking about like vinyl, like comedy albums.
It doesn't
albums.
Have to be vinyl, honestly.
Yeah, but I mean, or like cassettes. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, I found, like, I loved Bill Cosby because it was just totally hilarious stories about life, you know? And with my writing, like I like to just write about relatable situations, because I feel like our everyday lives are full of hilarious, embarrassing, fascinating moments.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Steve Martin is obviously a lot more kind of off the wall
sure.
and kind of cerebral. And he's also somebody who, although whether he was like deconstructing the form, was certainly like often deconstructing the form of the stand-up comic.
Yeah.
And that's an influence on me as well, not just because it's sort of like a very sophisticated mind often doing totally dopey comedy mm-hmm. or like silly, zany ideas. I like that too, because I mean, I like to try to bring a sophistication even to the scatological humor that I use.
Sure.
Or to the sort of like sillier, more kind of like whimsical moments.
Yeah.
That's what I remember, it's not just one out. I mean, I just remember listening to tons of their stuff and, mm-hmm. And both of them have been huge influences on me.
Yeah. It's hard to make a good scatological reference unless, again, you're trying to bring some intelligence to it, because it will read as just, oh, I plugged in a joke here. That's the other thing.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we go scatological, we go edgy in What If. It's not, I mean, I think sometimes you see the trailer and it looks like it's going to be this very like lightweight, whimsical movie, but it that's marketing. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, it's actually a much sort of more nuanced, but also like edgy and sort of weird and yeah, sometimes scatological movie. I mean, it's the director of Goon. Mm-hmm. But it was also intentional because, you know, you have two characters who are trying to maintain a friendship. And there's something kind of adolescent about two kind of like grown-up, sexually active adults, you know, who in any other situation would be attracted to each other. Mm-hmm. Basically, I mean, clearly are attracted to each other, but are sort of like suppressing that sure. to make the friendship work. And part of the scatology that I used and the sort of the fascination with like things that are kind of like gross or dirty or sexual, not sexual intentionally, because I kind of wanted their sense of humor to feel a bit adolescent together. Because
okay.
the sex stuff is stuff they can't talk about.
Sure.
And other characters in the movie talk very frankly about sex. But I kind of wanted to leave that off the table for Daniel and Zoe's characters, because to go there would be to sort of like open up a door
yeah.
that their relationship can't. So they talk about, you know, like how much feces were in the bodies of celebrities when they died, and like, you know, yeah. like they discuss like really disgusting foods, uh-huh. and they talk about a lot of stuff that they talk about it in a funny, zippy, bantery, sophisticated way, but they're talking about really silly things, and that was intentional
yeah.
because I wanted their relationship to feel adolescent in that way, yeah. and I mean that was what something that, you know, that idea of like a lot of intelligence even when it's being used for something silly, it's something that I, you know, from Bob and Doug McKenzie, from Steve Martin for sure.
Mm-hmm. So let's see. We talked a little bit about it, but did you make any friends over comedy, or was it just something that you guys shared because it was in the culture?
Yeah, it's more like you recognize a like-minded individual mm-hmm. by their comedy references, you know? And for some people, it's, I mean, Monty Python, obviously, mm-hmm. massive. Kids in the Hall was really huge
sure.
when I was high school and university. They're Canadian.
Sure.
They were deeply weird
mm-hmm.
and deeply, deeply weird. And also in that SCTV style, hyper committed to their characters,
mm-hmm.
Even when their characters were losers or weirdos or bad at their jobs, or they weren't half-assing it the way Bob and Doug McKenzie were often half-assing it, but
yeah.
there was like a total commitment to the character,
yeah.
even when they're doing the weirdest, strangest, kind of like most off the wall things.
When this stuff, obviously, this stuff holds up, but was there a sense at that time when like the state was on the air, was this feeling old hat to some people? Was it already being pushed out, or is there still a sense of nostalgia where they were still being respected? Because now they are, but I feel like sometimes it takes a little time.
Yeah, I mean, I think it also, you know, what ends up happening, I think, with a lot of comedy is mm-hmm. what happens to the performer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, some comedians or comic actors, like they keep on top of their game. You know, like Bill Murray is probably more respected now mm-hmm. than he was, you know, then. And so you sort of also look back on it fondly.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think sometimes when comic actors don't necessarily, or comedians, like they go softer or they don't stay as relevant, there can be a tendency to look back on their stuff less kindly, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, like Bob and Doug McKenzie are probably, I think, on a widespread level, looked on it kind of like an artifact at the time,
mm-hmm.
like a real communal, hilarious thing. But they sort of, you know, Wayne's World came out and kind of essentially found a modern version of their
sure.
shtick. And, you know, the SCTV's influence in general became very diffuse. Everybody, you know, even the incredibly famous people that, you know, famous comedians and comic actors that came out of it became famous for other things, you
yeah.
know? I mean, people don't necessarily, I mean, Martin Short is famous for a lot of other things other
yes.
than SCTV.
Sure.
Even if that's where you first discovered him. And so, I would say they probably are seen as like an artifact of the past, but I think they're looked on very warmly. Yeah. There's a tremendous amount of nostalgia. And in some cases, you know, like Rick Moranis kind of like disappeared.
I know.
And so there was a bit of a sense of like, he kind of went like Salinger on people. And this is, you know, I mean, and so there's a real warmth. I mean, I can't speak for Americans, but for Canadians, I mean, there's like a tremendous amount of warmth and affinity for these guys. But it does also feel like a simpler time.
Sure. Is there a favorite bit from this album?
Favorite bit. I mean, so
because the thing many. Is, it is continuous. Essentially, the bits are almost indistinguishable.
I love Beer Hunter.
Mm-hmm.
I love Welcome to Side Two. I love. I love just the whole build up with Take Off. I mean, I love when they're just talking. I mean, yeah. I mean, even just like the first track. Like the first track just really tells you what you know. It opens with a can of beer opening, and then it opens with them saying, "Oh, we should keep that. That's a good opening." You know, like I mean, it's like it gets both clever and self-referential, but it's clever and stupid and totally smart about its stupidity.
Yeah.
So there's so many. It's hard to kind of like you know. I mean, it's hard to sort of separate out which ones I love. I have to say, as I'm looking at the track list, I love You Are Our Guest, which is the one where you're actually supposed to look on page 2 of like the liner notes and read along with them because talk about not just that it's funny. There's these like really long spaces where you're supposed to be talking and some of them are long and so you're like so I'm basically if you're not sitting at it like reading along with them which feels ridiculous to do. You're just listening to dead air and yet the dead air is funny and that's an amazing accomplishment to create a sense where actually listening to nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Is funny,
mm-hmm.
And the way that the whole thing like escalates and degenerates, really, I think it's just so so funny, so stupid, so meta, and so so great.
I think you've already made a case for this, but towards the end, I always ask people if you don't know who Bob and Doug McKenzie are, if you don't know who SCTV is, if you somehow don't know who Rick Moranis and Dave Thomas are, what's a good condense the whole episode. I hope people aren't flipping forward to people's condensing episode, but why listen
too long
to this
didn't
album?
Read. Yeah. Why listen to this album?
For somebody to whom it does not have a childhood connection. You
know? Sure. Well, it's incredibly irreverent and breezy. It plays with the form in a way that is certainly of its time, but also, it feels very modern because it's so irreverent about that. Mm-hmm. But more than anything, this was an incredibly influential album for like an entire generation of Canadian comedians, comics, actors, writers who have totally infiltrated your society in a level that you don't even realize because you don't really know who the Canadians are.
Yep.
And so maybe by listening to this album, you can decode that and so you can understand who are the Canadians among you and so that you can drive them out.
That's perfect. Where can people find you on Twitter and then the movie?
You can find me on Twitter at Elan Mastai, so ELANMASTAI. My name is complicated enough. I'm not going to make it more complicated by having a random Twitter handle, so you can find me on Twitter there. The movie, What If? It opens on limited release in 10 cities across the U.S. on Friday, August 8th, and then goes wide on Friday, August 15th.
Mm-hmm.
I encourage you to check it out. It's a very sweet, very, very funny relationship comedy that... you know, I think that it makes for a great date. It makes for a great fun night out. You're not going to feel dirty for enjoying this romantic comedy. In fact, it's the dirtiness that's going to make you feel clean.
That's awesome. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
Well,
it was great.
I mean, it's not my place, but you know what I'm saying. And thank you guys for listening. And as always, have a good thing. Comedy on Vinyl is a production of Stolen Dress Entertainment. It is produced by Mike Warden and is hosted and edited by Jason Klom. Our theme song was composed and performed by Richard Levinson. Please visit stolendress.com to listen to our other podcasts, read our blogs, read our tweets, watch our videos, and read our books. Please subscribe on iTunes, and if you like us, give us a 5-star rating and a nice review. You can find us on facebook.com/comedyonvinyl, Twitter @comedyonvinyl, and find everything else at comedyonvinyl.com.
This is where the DJ talks. Don't say anything.
Okay.
Oh, beauty, go.
Okay. Good day, welcome to our single. I'm Bob McKenzie, and this is my brother Doug.
How's it going, eh?
Beauty, eh?
Yeah, I like that.
Okay.
Okay, everyone, this record was my idea.
Get out.
It was.
You're lying.
heat hose head here just sort of rid on my coattails.
Why are you doing this? It was our idea together, right?
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
okay.
We agreed to say that, but...
Aw, take off!
Saying, eh?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's good. Okay, so good day. Our topic today is music.
That's right, like, because my brother and I are now experts in the field,
yeah,
eh?
Yeah, right, because we're a band now. And, yeah.
Well, so. Except for him. I'm a band.
Oh, how can you do that, making me look bad? You're such a hose hand.
Yeah, well, take off!
Take off to the great white north. Take off. It's a beauty way to go.
Listen to this, it's coming. You know what it is?
What?
It's a drum solo.
Okay, everyone, like, this is me on the drums,
oh,
eh?
Get out. It is not.
It
You're
is
lying.
So.
Stop
I
lying,
learned.
Will you?
Take off, eh?
Oh,
take off to the great white north. Take off. It's a beauty way to go. Take off to the great white north. Take off. It's a beauty way to go. Take off.
Beauty, eh?
Like magic, eh?
Yeah.
It's coming in.
Well, that's
like it was sung by angels.
Hey, Jose.
Yeah, what?
Guess what?
What?
It's over.
Take off. That
no,
can't be.
It is. Yeah, it is. Because
what?
Well, hit records are short.
Like, no way.
Yeah, they're not that long. Okay, so that's our topic for today. So, good day.
Good day.
And you guys,
what?
Take off.
Hey, no. Hey, don't go.
No, come back, eh?
Oh, look what you did. Everybody's gone.
You
see you.
Come back.
I won't let him do it again.
Yeah.
Such a hoser.
There's no way I'll ever do another record with you, hoser.
Yeah. Okay, that's fine. I'll do a solo album.
Fine, and you'll be looking for me
yeah,
like
I
on
will
another
not.
Label.
Oh, now everybody's gone.
Good
so.
Day.
Good day.